From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's that time of year again. Tax man's coming for all of us tomorrow. And in the midst of our rolling debates on our tax system, from the Bush tax cuts to the Buffett rule to the president's public tax returns, we're wondering, is this the best we've got? 26 years since our last big tax reform. Forms are convoluted, deductions are complicated, all sorts of loopholes and entitlements. What's it worth? Are we ready for a new system entirely? This hour, On Point, on the eve of your tax filing deadline, your American taxes. You can join the conversation. Have you filed your taxes yet? Still playing with the numbers? Hoping for something less complicated? You can comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A special welcome today to our newest listeners at Marfa Public Radio in West Texas. We're glad you're here. Now, in a moment, we'll hear from two big tax experts, one Republican, one Democrat, on what's broken and not broken in our tax system. But joining me first for a look at the looming tax deadline is Peggy Collins. She covers personal finance for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi, Peggy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, a basic question. We know that Sunday was April 15th. So why isn't today the tax deadline? Why is it tomorrow?
So there's actually a tax holiday. Well, I should say a holiday in D.C. today. So the tax filing deadline is actually not until tomorrow, so that the IRS can give everybody the same deadline and not have to extend it for one area of the country versus another. So, yes, we got two extra days to file this year, and actually three if you count in leap year, the leap day that we had.
Wonderful. I'm sure that'll make everybody's mood better. Let me ask you this, though. Many people have filed already. My 22-year-old daughter's already gotten her $162 tax refund. What proportion of Americans have not filed to this point?
So the latest filing data that the IRS has is through April 6th. So that was with about a week and a half to go. And at that point, about 99 million returns had been received by the IRS by individuals. So, and last year, about 145 million people filed. So it was looking like, you know, about two-thirds of people had filed by April 6th. So another one-third were scheduled to come in. And as you mentioned about your daughter's tax refund, the average tax refund that people are getting this year looks to be around $3,000. So a little bit more than what your daughter received, thankfully, for a lot of people.
Darn, she'll be upset. Let me ask you about the pace of refunds. Do the IRS performs differently in different years? Is this a year where things seem to be going smoothly and refunds are being processed rapidly or less so?
You know, we've heard from a lot of experts and people in different parts of the country, including tax preparers at H&R Block, that there have been some delays with refunds this year. The IRS still says that e-filing, filing electronically, is the best way and the fastest way to get your refund, and you should get it within 10 to 21 days. But we have heard of some delays this year. There were some changes to the IRS's tax filing system that may have slowed some things down, and we have heard some reports of delays. But again, 10 to 21 days is what the IRS says you should expect to get your refund within if you file electronically.
And what proportion of Americans have switched over to electronic filing and gone paperless?
You know, I was looking at the stats this morning. So of that 99 million of people that had filed returns by around April 6th, about 86 million of them were coming in by e-filing. So it's well over three quarters. So, and the IRS has done a lot of promotional activities to encourage people to file online, no matter what your income level is.
Wow, that's a lot more rapidly than I would have expected. I guess in everything, as in reading books and newspapers, the digital revolution is going very fast. One final thing before I let you go, Peggy. If you are one of those, couple of scores of millions of Americans who haven't filed yet, and you're sort of panicked at the last minute about getting it all done, from what you talk to, the people you talk to at the IRS and elsewhere, what advice do they have for those people?
So you can file for a six-month extension. A lot of people do that if they have more complicated returns or they've procrastinated to the last minute. There's two things you should remember there. So you can get a six-month tax filing extension by going online to irs.gov and their free file site, and you can get an extension to file by October 15th. That's 6 months. The most important thing to remember is it is an extension to file, not to pay. So if you think you owe taxes, you still need to estimate about how much you owe and pay that amount by April 17th to avoid any penalties.
So just like Mitt Romney, the ordinary American who has requested an extension, the ordinary American can go online, and so long as they pay estimated taxes, they can also get a six-month delay.
Exactly. And with how complicated our tax code is, as I expect you're going to be talking about for the rest of this hour, a lot of people do file extensions now because they want to make sure they're getting the credits and deductions, but it's quite complicated to figure it all out for some people by the deadline.
Peggy, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Peggy Collins covers personal finance for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Business Week. She spoke with me from New York. Now let's go to the big picture on our taxes. Joining me now from Washington is Neera Tanden, president of the Center for American Progress and counselor to the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Neera was director of domestic policy for the Obama-Biden presidential campaign, former senior advisor to the Department of Health and Human Services. She's had her head in the tax issue for quite some time. Neera Tanden, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
And also with us in Washington is Steve Bell, Senior Director for Economic Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Steve was former staff director of the Senate Budget Committee under New Mexico Republican Senator Pete Domenici. He's also spent a decade as a managing director with the Wall Street Investment Bank, then known as Salomon Brothers. Steve Bell, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here, John.
Steve, let me start with you and ask this question about our tax code. Have you filed your return yet? And Neera, same question to you.
I have not, and I'll probably request an extension.
I have. We filed it a few months ago.
Well, that's efficient. Let me ask you.
It's also rare for me.
Right. Well, you're a very well-organized person. When you think about the tax code, Neera Tanden, do you think the problem is the complexity of the code, the fact that it doesn't raise enough money or raises too much money, or that it raises money from the wrong people?
I think it's all of the above. I think it is too complicated. We do need to simplify the tax code. I think it is we have a long-term challenge with the fact that we're not raising enough revenue and that we're at historically low rates of revenue that's being raised. And also that we, you know, the code is not fair, and we should have more fairness in our tax system and sure that everyone's paying their fair share, including the wealthiest.
Steve, do you agree with all those points? Too complicated, doesn't raise enough money, and isn't fair?
I think the first two I absolutely agree with. It is too complicated, especially in the last 25 years since the 86 Tax Act. I'm not sure about fairness. It's reasonably progressive. The most unfair part about it are what we call the tax expenditures, all of these tax breaks that people in various categories can apply for. But the vast majority of these tax expenditures go to wealthy people, and the vast majority of people who file are not wealthy and don't take advantage of them.
Neera, Steve Bell says we already have a progressive tax system. So why is it unfair?
Well, I mean, if you look at where we've been, the wealthiest are paying, themselves, historically low tax rates. I think in the economy we have, where the wealthiest 1% are getting a large share of the benefits of the economy. In fact, in 2010, 93% of income growth went to the top 1%. I think it's actually a travesty that the wealthiest are paying the lowest percentage share of the overall tax code or tax revenue that we're raising in decades. And so I think that all of these are challenges we should address, and we should address them together.
Steve, we know that the two parties are evenly balanced in Washington. They have been for some time. It's not easy to get very much done. What do you believe are the prospects, realistically, that the tax code can be changed in significant ways in the next year or two?
I think the prospects are as good as they've been in many years. A lot of things are going to precipitate action, it seems to me, on the legislative calendar. We all know that we're going to have a pretty big mess in the lame duck session after the elections are done in November. We know the Bush tax cuts are supposed to expire in January. We have a major across-the-board cuts called sequestration, also in January, that's going to cut $1.2 billion, a trillion rather, out of spending.
That sounds ugly.
Oh, it is going to be ugly. It also comes out of the part of the budget that doesn't contribute much to the deficit or the debt we expect. So we're going to, and we'll have a debt ceiling of some kind, either in January or late December, that we have to deal with. And so I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity if the Congress wants to take it to at least begin the reform of the code. It has to be done all together, in my view, not a bite at a time. And that's going to cause substantial delay. But I think there is the best chance we have in 2013 and early 14.
Nara, do you believe it's going to happen, whether or not President Obama is reelected or whether Mitt Romney wins the presidency?
You know, I agree with Steve on this. I think we have the best opportunity to have reform of the tax code as we've seen in decades. I do think all three of these issues are creating pressure. My hope is that because of these pressures that Republicans will actually address issues of revenue in the budget deal, and that may introduce a stronger or a more robust conversation about reform itself.
Does it depend on President Obama's reelection?
Well, I think that there's likely to be a discussion either way. I think if the if there is a President Romney, that he may just actually try to do. I think we'll have less likely reform, and just he'll try to implement massive tax cuts for the wealthy and others.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about what's in play for the future of our tax system. Now, on Saturday, President Obama talked about our tax system and how he thinks it ought to be reformed fundamentally. We've also got a clip from Mitt Romney at the Detroit Economic Club on his vision for the tax system. Let's listen to both.
We live in the real world with real choices and real consequences. Right now, we've got significant deficits to close. We've got serious investments to make to keep our economy growing. And we can't afford to keep spending more money on tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans who don't need them and didn't even ask for them.
And here's Mitt Romney at the Detroit Economic Club in February.
Now, of course, I'm going to maintain the 15% capital gains tax rate. That's the right course to keep our economy growing. I'll eliminate the tax entirely, by the way. Entirely. Capital gains, interest, and dividends. I'll eliminate that for those with annual income below $200,000. Those low tax rates encourage Americans to save and to invest, and they'll encourage business investment and economic growth. And finally, I will repeal the alternative minimum tax, and I will abolish the death tax. It's simply not fair.
Joining me today from Washington is Nira Tandon, president of the Center for American Progress and counselor to their Action Fund. And also in Washington, Steve Bell, senior director of economic policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Nira, let me start with you. When you think of the most egregious flaws in our tax code, that is the deductions that should not exist, the loopholes and preferences that should not exist, what are they?
Well, look, I think there are a number of challenges in our tax code. Number one, we have a number of ways in which our tax code actually works as spending for particular interests and industries. We hear a lot of roiling and an attack on earmarks. But essentially what's happened is our tax code is riddled with a version of earmarks, which are loopholes and tax breaks for corporations. So obviously there's the ones we know all about, oil and gas, and other ones, carried interest, as a way in which we have special tax favored treatment for hedge funds. And I think a variety of these, you know, they raise some revenue, but more importantly, they become symbolic ways in which the tax code is really rigged for those people who have money in Washington and who can lobby on their own behalf. And when they once they get installed in the tax code, we can't really get rid of them. I mean, here we are in serious and significant deficit reduction, need for deficit reduction, and we can't even get rid of an oil and gas tax credit or tax break for companies. So I think that those kind of breed cynicism. They're not large scale, but they're egregious. And also there are a variety of ways in which the tax code does help wealthy Americans through tax deductions for mortgages on their second homes and other issues in which the system pretty much provides greater relief for wealthy Americans through these expenditures than middle-class Americans, and those add up to real revenue.
Steve, if you think about the 70,000 pages of the IRS code, and then you think about some element or two or three in the code that makes you think that's outrageous, what do you think of?
Oh, I think the symbolism aspect is important. I think the most outrageous is the second home mortgage interest deduction. And I also have to say that for people who have mortgages over $500,000 at, let's say, 4.5% interest, those folks in all likelihood, given that the average house in this country is less than $200,000 mortgage, those folks are getting an outrageous break. Now, when I say that, I know that the realtors next month in May are going to descend on Washington, D.C. to lobby very hard to keep the mortgage interest deduction. But if I look at the mortgage interest deduction, if I look at tiny things like airplane deductions and yacht deductions, it's clear to me and to the
You sound like a Democrat.
Well, no, this is a matter really of looking at the code objectively. We have to be honest. When we had 19 people on our task force, we came up with a comprehensive tax reform plan. We had Democrats, Republicans, and folks in between, the so-called Domenici-Rivlin task force. And the consensus of all 19 from left to right was we have got to simplify the code. We've got to take the tax breaks out. They amount to $1 trillion in lost revenue a year. And right now, the vast majority of people who take advantage of these deductions are the people who can afford to. And that is people who, you mentioned carried interest, similar things like that, that do not in general benefit the economic health of the country and do distort economic incentives. And that's not Democratic or Republican. It's just a fact.
Nero, let me ask you about something different from yacht and jet deductions and oil and gas, but the very, very large exclusion that employers get right now from paying taxes on the value of the health insurance they provide to their workers. I was talking yesterday to former Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire, and he said, well, if you really wanted to do something to control health care costs and raise a ton of revenue, get rid of that exclusion. You had a chance to do that when you were advising the president on health policy. Why didn't he do it?
Well, see, I think this is an excellent way in which tax policy and domestic policy or the policies the country has on other issues interact. So the tax exclusion came into play and was formed after World War II when essentially we were trying to figure out ways to provide health insurance to Americans. And we didn't want to have basically a public health care system for all Americans. So in essence, we used the tax code to subsidize employers to provide health insurance. And as you noted, we discussed that during health reform, and we did limit the value of the benefit for high income plans because there was a concern that this was inflationary, that basically employers were creating more and more expensive plans to get the value of the tax credit. So that was limited. The concern I have about eliminating the exclusion is that, there are unforeseen consequences, or actually very foreseen consequences, which is if we just eliminated the exclusion, we would dramatically drop health coverage rates in today's environment. But with the Affordable Care Act, what would happen is we would dramatically drop coverage rates, and then we'd be picking up a lot of added expense through the subsidies that the federal government is providing. So essentially, people would move off of employer-based plans and move into national health exchanges. And so our costs would actually likely go up under that system because employers would actually not be providing subsidy. And so I think I appreciate the interest of folks who want to simplify the tax code, but there is a value that we all have believed in ensuring that we are covering, Americans have health insurance. And if we just eliminated the exclusion, you know, we would likely have millions of Americans drop from coverage, and it could be picked up through the Affordable Care Act.
All right, I want to bring some of our listeners into the conversation, and I want to start with Frederick from Buffalo, New York, who has an interesting point of view. His concern is not, Frederick, as I understand it, that the code is too complicated. What is your concern with the code?
Hi, John. Well, I actually personally file my own income tax every year, and I have no trouble with it, so mine's not too complicated. My situation is, though, rather simple. I'm a retired person who's just a single person, so I don't have a lot of expenses, and I live by myself. But I noticed that now that I'm retired, I'm paying a ridiculously low income tax. The code was supposed to forgive half my Social Security income. It basically forgave all of it. So none of my Social Security was taxed. So my total tax bill is $500 or less a year, which I think is way too low. And I also am a single person, and I have an opinion on the marriage penalty. The marriage penalty was created when John Kennedy actually put single people in a bracket that was lower than married people. That was wrong. The solution to the marriage tax is not to reduce taxes on married people. It's to put the taxes on single people back up to where they should be. And I personally think I would get rid of the entire Bush tax cut, and I would raise taxes way beyond where President Obama wants to go. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to deal with this deficit.
Frederick, thanks so much for your call. Steve Bell, just like Warren Buffett, Frederick thinks his taxes are too low. Is he right?
He is a rare man indeed. Taxes are not too low when you consider what people who work for a living are paying through the payroll tax, state taxes, and a variety of sales taxes. Add to that the federal income tax, and you really have a tax burden, especially on people below $200,000 a year. So just a general tax increase not only would be counterproductive, but probably, given the weak state of the economy right now, would probably lead us back into a recession. At least that's what the Congressional Budget Office has said. If the Bush tax cuts were to expire entirely and the automatic across-the-board cuts were to occur, CBO estimates we'd lose about 3% of GDP growth, and most economists think we're about 2% now. So if you want to go into negative growth and make the deficit problem worse, then you can let all these tax cuts go into effect and all these cuts go into effect. But that's not a rational way to approach it.
All right, I'm going to go now to Vinny from Morgantown, Pennsylvania. Vinny, thanks for joining us on the program. Frederick, who preceded you on the line, said taxes are too low. You agree?
No, sir. Thank you for having me on, John. Good show. I'm tired of these liberals always taxing the rich. Oh, tax cuts for the rich. Where are you going to cut taxes? On the people that pay no taxes? And I'm tired of it. My wife, 6 years ago, lost her job. Her boss was rich. He owned a coffee and water company. Taxes got so high, Monday morning, he called them all in and said, Friday, I'm closing up the business. My wife and 35 people unemployed. I love rich people. I'm a one-man carpenter business, and they give me the work. We cannot tax these people. And as far as the second home, like that lady said, that second home, they pay more property taxes, which helps the local economies, pave the roads, maintain the sewer systems. The second home also provides jobs for maybe gardeners or repairmen who do work on the house. What are these people thinking? And corporations, final thought, there is no corporation in the world that pays taxes. They are simply tax collectors. The consumer is the person who pays the taxes. You increase tax on corporation, the price to the consumer goes up. So I'd like some answers from the liberals who are just, they're mind dead. I don't understand it.
Vinny, thanks so much for your call. I think we have a liberal on this program, and I'm going to go to her right now.
I think he was talking about me. So let me say a few things about that. First, I think that the connection between taxes and tax rates and the economy and economic growth is one that many people think you know, goes hand in hand. But obviously, it's a complicated story. And if you look at the broad swath of our history over the last 60 years, when we've had incredibly high tax rates, we've also had incredibly high growth. And when we've had lower tax rates, in fact, over the last decade during the Bush presidency, we've had the lowest tax rates we've had in our history, especially for the highest income. And we've had the lowest growth rates, obviously, in the early 90s. Just to finish on that, in the early 90s, President Clinton raised taxes on the wealthy. The marginal tax rate went up for the highest income Americans. We had a decade of strong and robust growth. That's not to say that we should eliminate, you know, we should go back to, we should raise taxes across the board. But I think this idea that raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans lowers growth rates, raising federal income taxes lowers growth rates, has just been belied by our history. And, you know, I think it's just wrong. And so, you know, whether there is a tax rate, you know, obviously there are tax rates that can become punitive, but we are nowhere near that for the highest income Americans. And in fact, you know, 31% millionaire tax rates have dropped sharply from an average of about 31% in the mid-1990s to an average of 24% today, at a time where we've had increasing inequality and we don't have enough growth for middle-income Americans. Middle-income Americans' wages are stagnating, but wealthier Americans are doing well. I think there's something wrong with that picture.
Steve, do you agree with Nira, or do you think Vinny has a point that if you impose things like the Buffett rule, if you raise taxes on the top end, you're going to see a consequence, whether it's in terms of service employment or other job creation?
Well, I'm on Vinny's side on this. We have to be honest and talk about the underlying problem. We don't have good economic growth in this country. How do you get good economic growth so that more people are employed, which to a great extent helps reduce the projected deficits and indebtedness of the federal government? Well, obviously, raising taxes, especially on corporations, leads to exactly what Vinny said. Consumers get to pay more. They get less bang for their buck. Total reform of the code as an entity probably would make business increase 2 to 3 percentage points across the board, because it would at some point make things rational. We wouldn't have, for example, an extreme advantage to people who have second homes. However, we would not also have 47 to 50% of the people in this country who work not paying any taxes. There is a very complicated belief that what you can do, and it's very prevalent in the presidential campaign in France right now, that what you can do is tax very, very wealthy people a great deal with no consequence. That is wrong. People will change. People will move to other places. And in the case of carried interest, which is a favorite of Wall Street, people can move to London just as easily as they can do that work in Wall Street. So you have to have economic growth, and you have to have a rational tax system that doesn't retard growth.
But do you think, Steve, the rates that obtained at the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, the 39.6 that the president wants to go back to, are those the kind of rates that would substantially diminish economic activity and make people move to London?
I don't think so. You know, 36 to 39.6 for people over a certain income bracket who take advantage of deductions already probably is not a significant burden. But that is, again, a way to avoid the fundamental question. Fundamental tax reform coupled with entitlement reform, which we have not undertaken to any degree at all in this country, those are the things that are going to get economic growth back again, and which are going to allow our very high indebtedness to at least stabilize. Well, it'll stabilize at numbers much higher.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. Welcome back. On the eve of the deadline, we're talking taxes from Bush to Buffett. I want to play one more clip of the president the other day comparing the Buffett rule that he's proposed to the tax policies pursued by Ronald Reagan.
What Ronald Reagan was calling for then is the same thing that we're calling for now. A return to basic fairness and responsibility. Everybody doing their part. And if it'll help convince folks
in Congress to make the right choice, we could call it the Reagan rule instead of the Buffett rule.
Now, we're talking today with the president of the Center for American Progress, Neera Tanden, and senior director of economic policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Steve Bell. Now, Steve, you knew Ronald Reagan. You served with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan might even have been a friend of yours. Does President Obama and what he is proposing on tax policy sound to you like Ronald Reagan?
Oh, my goodness, no. We had, when I was staff director of the Budget Committee, David Stockman was the OMB director, and Senator Domenici was chairman of the Budget Committee. I cannot tell you the times that we had extremely candid conversations, full of very short monosyllabic words about the tax code. Domenici and his staff were among the people that thought, well, you know, we have to be careful given deficits that are projected, that we don't go too far on tax cuts. I can tell you that every single person we dealt with in the Reagan administration at the senior level was strongly against that. So maybe the word fairness that Ronald Reagan used is what the president is discussing. But I can tell you that Ronald Reagan was as tough as a boot, as they say back home, when it came to defending lower taxes.
So, Neera, is the Ronald Reagan embrace a bit of play acting by the president?
No, I actually think just what Steve was talking about is a cautionary tale about these budget issues and budget policies. Obviously, I mean, if you read David Stockman's book, The Triumph of Politics, what happened in the 80s is we cut taxes and we didn't have the concomitant cuts in other areas, and we've been living with a lot of consequences from that. And I think that, you know, what the president is talking about is very accurate. Basically, President Reagan was concerned, and, you know, Cap is actually proud of being the first people to find the video. You know, Reagan was expressing concern about a tax code that seems unfair when, you know, secretaries and working families pay much more or pay any more, actually, than millionaires, et cetera. And I think the fact that we have that concern that's a real legitimate concern. And I think the challenge for tax reformers like Steve and others is that if we don't make the system more fair and don't ask for wealthy Americans to pay their fair share, we can't get broader agreement on a whole host of other issues because people feel like the game is rigged against them, and the tax code is the most obvious way. You know, I think Steve creates a false contrast between tax fairness for the highest income Americans and simplifying the code. You know, we can do both of those things. We can make the code simpler and fairer. And I think that that's the challenge for policymakers over the next several years.
Simpler and fairer. Let's bring our listeners into that tax reform conversation. We've got on the line Joe from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Joe, thanks for coming on Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Tell me what your conception is of what ought to be done with this tax code.
Many years ago, I was speaking with an accountant friend of mine who said, accounting firms don't make money doing income tax for the people. They make money doing other things for big business. Income taxes are not a moneymaker for accountants. I asked him, if everybody paid just an exact percentage of what they make, whether it be $100 or $100 million, they should pay the same percentage, what would happen? And I said, would they pay maybe 0.1% of what they make as a tax? And he said, probably less than that, if everybody just paid a tax and didn't do any discounts or deductions. Now, if you think about it, you don't have to do anything about, well, we got to fill up with this form to make it this way and this. Hey, I made $100 this week. Here's my tax. And I don't even have to ask the government to give it back to me because I'm only going to give them 50 cents on the $100 I made.
Joe, thanks so much for your call. There's a lot of appeal, Steve Bell, to simplicity. That sounds like a flat tax proposal. Is it a good idea?
I think the flat tax proposal is a good idea. You know, we've had various.
Could you get one half of 1% if you had a flat tax?
Oh, I don't think.
It sounds pretty low.
That's pretty low, and my brother is actually a CPA in South Carolina, so I sympathize a little bit with the caller and his CPA, but the fact is that's much too low. When we talk about taxes and we talk about spending, I think we heard earlier the phrase, if we're going to have a general agreement on other things, and I assume that meant on the spending side, we are going to have to, in some ways, both practically and symbolically, do something with the tax code. We're going to see that conflict later this year, John. We're going to see a fight, in my view, that Ronald Reagan faced in 1986. Will you accept some tax increases, kicking and screaming, in order to get more money for defense? And I think as we look forward to the lame duck session, that is exactly the tension that's going to confront the Congress. Do I think that we should have higher taxes on certain parts of the economy? Sure. Should we raise more revenue than we're raising now? Yes, of course. That's a matter of probably of arithmetic. But on the other side, you have to do something to cut spending as you, in fact, reform the tax code and raise revenue. And that has been the missing link so far in this entire debate, because everyone is afraid, both parties, of really going after where the spending occurs in the United States federal budget.
Let's bring another listener into the conversation. We've got on Chris from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Chris, how do you see this tax debate? Do you think that taxes need to be higher, lower, and what about spending?
Hi, John. Well, I cut my check this morning for my income tax. And
did it hurt?
Yes, but I accept it as a fact of life. The government does a lot for us. There's a lot of services, and I think that it's necessary. My husband and I are both self-employed. We definitely fall into that under $200,000 a year range. We paid about 28% income tax this year. And
I believe that's a higher proportion than President Obama paid. When he filed his public return the other day, he said that his effective tax rate was about 20%. Mitt Romney was about 15%.
Right. And actually, that's my problem. It's not that I paid a certain amount. It's that what seems unfair to me is that the tax rates vary. And it appears to be that the more money you make, the less your tax rate is. So to me, if I'm paying 28%, I want to see Mitt Romney pay 28%. I want to see, you know, all the Republicans that are out there talking, I want to see them pay 28% too. I feel like, especially in the case of those that are very wealthy, the pain of paying 28% is not anywhere near the pain of paying 28% if you're making, say, $100,000 a year. And that is what feels unfair to me. Not that I have to pay taxes, but that I get to pay a higher proportion than many other people in this country, especially people that are making a lot of money, that have the means to have lobbyists go and, you know, get their tax rates cut. That's what feels unfair to me. I heard somebody once say, I want to pay a lot of tax because it means I'm making a lot of money. And I think that's a really fair statement. If you're making a lot of money, then you should also probably be cutting a relatively significant check. Sure, I'd love to see tax rates go down, but what I really want to see is I want to see the tax code be fair and that everybody is sharing the same proportion with the government. If we have to have taxes, it should be fair.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. Neera, let me ask you, you heard Chris say the pain itself isn't the problem. It is the fact that everybody shares in the pain. You look at public opinion polling, and her position that the rich ought to pay more than they are now is very popular. So why hasn't the president and the Democrats in Congress been able to get this done?
Well, I think the big challenge we've had over the last 2 years, and one of the reasons why, or actually the reason why, last summer's debt negotiations collapsed was because Republicans have been intransigent on the issue of revenues, and they've been intransigent on the issue of revenues for anyone, anywhere, you know, intransigent on revenues for the highest income Americans, corporate oil taxes we're seeing impossible to get through, just that repeal through this Congress. So I think my hope is actually that this election will be waged on that particular question of fairness in the tax code. And if the president is reelected, that we can actually have some movement on this issue. And I think, you know, the caller speaks to a lot of Americans. If you actually look at polling on the tax code, you know, in the last several years, about 50% of Americans think that taxes are about right and federal taxes for them, but they are also concerned about the, you know, that the system is kind of rigged against them. And so, you know, I think that we would actually be able to solve a lot of problems in the country if people had renewed confidence that the government is fair, and the tax code is a way in which all Americans come interact with it, or most Americans interact with it, and you know about it, and they feel like, you know, there's benefits going to the wealthiest and most well-connected, and that is a problem for all of us, and that we should be able to fix.
Nira, let me ask you about the flip side of that. We heard from several of the Republican presidential candidates during the primary season that they thought it was unfair that somewhere between 40% and 50% of Americans don't pay income tax because of the level of exemptions or the earned income tax credit or other tax preferences they get. They don't make enough money. Is that unfair?
You know, I have to say, I find the issues around fairness really breathtaking. You know, we have in this economy, we've had all of the benefits, really, of growth in less, and the minimal growth we've had in the last 3 years, really skew to the wealthiest Americans. Middle-class Americans, lower-income Americans are really struggling. We've had more people fall into poverty, and yet the problems that the Republicans have identified is that middle-class, hardworking families are paying too little in taxes, not that wealthy billionaires and millionaires are paying too little. I think that's completely skewed. I'd be willing to look at fairness across the board if Republicans would be honest and look at the wealthiest and have them pay their fair share first. So I think, I think the caller really identifies this problem. We're not going to get people to believe in everyone sacrificing until those who can sacrifice the easiest step up. And the challenge of this is, you know, lots of well-off Americans want to do it. We just have a Republican Congress and Republicans running for president, including Mitt Romney, talking about lowering their taxes and cutting spending and raising, ensuring that more and more people don't have benefits and entitlements. And that's just not a conversation that's ever going to work unless everyone pays their fair share.
On the fair share point, we had a listener, Jonathan Spencer, write on Facebook, and I want to read his comment and Steve, get you to react to it. The Buffett rule will not solve the deficit problem, but few seem to understand the real point. If you do the math, it's obvious that we eventually have to raise taxes on everyone. This will be much easier to implement if the country feels those with the most money and power are paying their fair share. Steve, does that make sense to you?
Oh, I think psychologically it does. Never underestimate either party's ability to use what I call divide and conquer politics. And we're going to see a lot of it the rest of this year. On the one hand, we're going to have a lot of envy. We have the perfect target in Mitt Romney. Here's a guy that was successful. He made a lot of money, but he only pays 15% because of the way the tax code operates. And we're going to say what a bad guy he is, and it's just symbolic of one thing or the other. You know, I don't like symbolism as much as I like work. I think form is one thing, but substance is another. The millionaire's tax, it applies probably to 75,000 to 100,000 people in the country out of 140 million tax returns. Go ahead and do it, and over 10 years you'll raise about $47 billion. We're going to increase the debt of this country, predominantly by spending, up to around $25 to $26 trillion at the end of this 10-year period we're looking at. It just, if symbolism is what people want, and Warren Buffett, who used to be my boss, wants to pay more money, and we wanted to do away with carried interest, with the consequences of that, especially in New York, then we should do that. But we shouldn't trick ourselves into believing that we've done anything other than make ourselves feel good.
Steve, on this show, our listeners want substance and not symbolism, and I'm going to bring in one of them right now. Ben from West Hartford, Connecticut. Ben, what do you think about this interaction between the tax system and economic growth and job creation?
Well, first of all, let me address my comments to the mind-dead on the right. Because clearly they don't, they've bought into their own propaganda, and it's sad to me that so many middle class people have, and lower class people have bought into this. I am wealthy. I don't need lectures on how to make money or how to handle money, and I certainly don't want those kinds of lectures from poor people. But the truth of the matter is that 93% of the wealth over the last couple of years has in fact gone to the top 1%. And if it is true what Mitt Romney says, that, you know, well, this will help industry and the economy, then what the hell's happened in the last 2 years? Because it clearly has not. The other point that I want to make is that I have placed about $500,000 in my retirement accounts, and I don't want to quibble over the fact that it's a retirement account. The point is, it's $500,000, and I bought five stocks, $500,000 worth of five stocks, and I've been getting dividends over the last 2 years, and I've done fairly well, about 7% a year. Now, the irony of this is that allegedly, if you invest your money, these corporations are going to hire people, they're going to be job creators. Four of the five stocks I bought, those corporations laid off a minimum of 4 to 6% of their workforce during the time I was raking in the cash.
Ben, thanks so much for your call. Quick reaction, Steve and Nira. Steve?
Oh, I'm happy for him. I'm glad he's making a lot of money. But the fact of the matter is that people in his position need to start giving up their tax breaks and see how that impacts on them. And they need to also demand less spending of their taxes.
Nira, I'm guessing you agree with that point.
Yes, I do, at least on the tax side.
Nira Tandon, Steve Bell, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate your input. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. This tax reform discussion is not one that's going away. It will surely be around next year as well. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point Radio.